Today's conference is now being recorded.
Okay, it's Liz Gaster, and on the line with us so far, this is a call to talk about who is misrepresentation studies. So far, we have Glenda St. Jury, Lisa Pfeiffer, who's a consultant helping me on these studies, Bob Bruin, Steve Shang, Dave Piscatello, Adam Scoville, Greg Aaron, and Paul Diaz. Have I missed anyone? Okay. Hopefully everyone has two documents, this little chart of who is studies and the one document we're going to spend time on today called Who is Registrant Misrepresentation Study Definition, dated July 28th. Let me just very quickly give you some background on what the purpose of this call is today, and then we're going to spend some time doing a deep dive on this particular document. So the GNSO Council asked staff back in March of 2009 to examine the costs and feasibilities of doing a bunch of studies. I've changed the categories of the studies a little bit, but the first three studies that you see on this list are studies that the Council asked us to look at in March of this year, who is misuse, who is misrepresentation, and proxy and privacy services. The purpose of the call today is to talk about who is misrepresentation. Then there are two other, and these studies refer back to this motion in March that actually calls out six different studies. I've compressed them into three study groups. So anyone who has documents related to last March, including the resolution, will see six studies enumerated. They've actually been recategorized into, well, I should say four, because the fourth one on your document is also one of those initial six. I've just compressed them into four areas. And then in May of this year, they also asked staff to look at who is service requirements. That's listed as five on your list. But again, the purpose of today's call is just to discuss who is misrepresentation studies, the studies that were proposed that examine that in detail. Keep in mind that the purpose of the call is just to look at how a study or several studies on misrepresentation might be actually conducted, what the variables might be, what the sample size might be, what the how to test the hypotheses accurately. Lisa's going to step you through the document that you have in front of you that aims to examine that. And the purpose is not to debate whether we should do who is misrepresentation studies or not from a policy perspective. You may want to debate it from, if you think that there are difficulties in just the logistics of performing the study. But again, it's to look at the process of conducting the study, not to debate whether we should do the study or not. And the outcome of the document that Lisa has prepared here, called Who is Registrant Misrepresentation Study Definition, will become, it'll form essentially the basis of a request for proposal that we would post on the ICANN website, and we would solicit costs and feasibility based on a document like this one. So staff is not going to take this document and determine costs and feasibility ourselves. We may insert some comments or assessment of feasibility for further use or comment by others. But the purpose is simply to prepare an RFP that we could then solicit costs from the public, from researchers, and then present those the results of those RFPs to the Council sometime in the future, as soon as possible. And then the Council and staff would then decide ultimately what studies should be done. But what I'm really doing here is asking the original proponents of studies, several of you put for, or either yourselves put forward study proposals that look at who is misrepresentation, or organizations that you're affiliated with, like the APWG, put forth proposals to study misrepresentation. And so the purpose of this is to explore with study proposers what they think the puts and takes of conducting studies along the line of what Lisa has defined might be. So does anyone, and we are also conducting conversations, limited conversations, but trying to be as, you know, complete and thorough as we can on who is misuse, We've conducted a couple of calls already on who is misused. Those of you who are not on those calls who might want to comment on a document, just send me an email, and I'm happy to take your comments as long as you hurry with your responses. And then we have not yet started to look at proxy and privacy services, which the APWG also made a suggestion about, but we will be turning to that subject, and if you all would like to participate in that analysis, much like this one that we're going to do on misrepresentation today, I'm happy to include you in that process, too. So, again, it's just to ask more questions of smart minds in the course of examining what might be needed. And so I'd like, if you don't have any questions, I'll stop for just a quick moment, keeping questions to clarifying ones, if we could, about just the process and where we are in the process. And then I'd like to turn our attention to the misrepresentation study.
Liz, this is Lee Elgin. I don't know if you took a role at the beginning, but I joined a couple minutes late.
Great. Thanks, Lee. Glad to have you. And we just have an expanded group today, so I did a longer prelude than might be necessary otherwise.
Okay.
Any other people who want to identify themselves who've joined, or any other clarifying questions on process? Great.
I have one. Bob Bruin, I have one question on process.
Sure.
Will the studies have access to the escrow data the registrars have provided to ICANN, or is it strictly going to the registrars for current data?
Don't know yet. Trying to figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question, really. And others may have comments about that. Okay. One thing just, I'm going to introduce Lisa real quick. She's a consultant who's helping me develop these documents that will become RFPs. She's the person who's going to take you through this document on misrepresentation studies. She's going to draw your attention in particular to the boxes on each page and to the italicized text on each page where we've tried to ask questions of you that we're specifically seeking answers on. Hopefully you all have read through this document in advance of the call. If you're just looking at it, we'll try to take you through it, but we want to go as quickly through the content of it so that we can make use of your brain power on this call today, so we're going to keep that to a minimum if we can. But if you haven't read this and would like to provide comments later, you're welcome to do that through the end of this week. I recognize that all of you may not be prepared to offer comments today, but we do need to wrap up your input very quickly. So if you are not if you don't have comments on the phone, that's fine, but please let me know, and let me know to expect comments from you later this week, and we will incorporate them or consider them at that time. Okay, so let me turn this over to Lisa. Again, it's the italicized text we're focusing on, but if you have any questions or any comments on anything throughout this document so far, please feel free to ask.
Liz, did you want to also mention the relationship between this and the NORC accuracy
study? Yes, Lisa, I do. So our compliance group within ICANN is conducting a couple of different studies on WHOIS accuracy and on proxy and privacy services. And we've been working with them, talking to them about what they're doing. We're not experts on what they're doing in terms of being commenting to this group to describe any of what they're doing, but what I think is important takeaway for all of you is that we're conferring with NORC directly and attempting to use underlying data that they have already refined, defined, purified, if you will, for part of what we're trying to accomplish, which Lisa will describe more, to save money and save time and, you know, help with the efficiency piece. So those two activities are linked. Did I miss anything else, Lisa?
No, that's good. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. So this is Lisa Pfeiffer. What Liz and I tried to do when we started to look at the large set of potential studies and try to think about how you would actually group them in order to go about conducting them and conducting a small number of studies and grouping the items that would be the most related and would be touched upon in the same activity, we ended up breaking things into, as Liz said, three areas. an area that is focusing on looking at misuse of WHOIS information to perform harmful actions on registrants using their contact data. That's a separate activity that's not covered by this document. We also identified a third area, which would be actual abuse of privacy and proxy services, meaning looking at the relationship between documented harmful activities and how they map back to registrations that were made through a proxy service. Again, that's not what we're covering here. What we identified here was a set of studies that related specifically to misrepresentation of WHOIS information that's supplied either directly or through use of a privacy proxy service. And there were six studies that we actually grouped together here, all of which had to do with gathering information about what kinds of misrepresentation there might be. So, for example, GAC-5 was a study that proposed measuring the percentage of registrations by natural versus legal persons. GAC-6 proposed measuring percentage of registrations for commercial versus non-commercial use. And then there were other studies that we looked at and incorporated here, like Study 13, which talked about privacy proxy services, and Study 18, which was measuring the percentage of domains that were registered using privacy proxy services that were in some way miscategorized. So what we've tried to do here is combine those six into one study that focuses on looking at trying to define, based on a sample that's being developed by NORC, trying to define the number of or percentage of registrations that actually use privacy or proxy services to in some way misrepresent, either misrepresent a legal person as a natural person or try to somehow obfuscate the domain's non-personal or commercial business purpose. So that really is the goal of this study. And that at the beginning of study definition here, you'll see some definitions that are set out here. Those were derived from some input documentation. But just identifying what the hypothesis is, this study is trying to look at either proving or disproving that a significant percentage of domains that are actually registered with a privacy or proxy service are actually associated with WHOIS data that misrepresents them in one of those two ways. Now, before I go forward, I just wanted to emphasize that there would be then another study that would actually look at correlating privacy proxy services with harmful acts. That actually isn't covered in what we're doing here. First, we're going to start by looking at the relationship between just misrepresentation and privacy and proxy services. But I'd like to pause here and ask, for those of you that have had a chance to look at the document, do you feel that in general the study that's described here will actually address the hypothesis?
Okay, this is Bob Bruin again. I have a question. I haven't seen or heard, maybe I just missed it. Is there a sense of how many registrants have used it out of the total number of domains that are registered, have just used the services, whether it's been misrepresented or anything, just some kind of a base number?
Not sure I know your question. You mean used it how?
No, they're just the use of privacy protection or proxy services. Do we know how many or percentage or number or whatever of all the ones that are out there are used?
But I think that's one of the studies that the compliance group is.
That's the one that they're doing. So there'll be
and
a number.
And they're looking at, then there are some specific studies that we're doing with proxy and privacy services subsequently.
Right. You're looking at misrepresentation, but I was trying to figure out if there was some number that you were going to have a misrepresentation of that. You know, how many inside the whole number? Because I don't have any sense of how many times people have actually used this or not used it. And I don't know if the 2,400 domains you've mentioned represents a tiny fraction of that or a large fraction of that or whatever. I have nothing. I don't have context.
The 2,400 domain, I don't know the answer to your question, Bob, but I do know that the 2,400 domains, the reason that the NORC accuracy study picked that number and actually picked the composition of that set of 2,400 domains was to be representative of the top five GTLDs and to be able to come up with statistics that were meaningful within a 5% sort of error factor, so the 95% confidence interval. Now,
I understand all that, but I just didn't know what that 2,400 related to. I mean, if there were 10 million uses of privacy protection, I don't know the 2,400 would be a representative number of that or not. So I was just wondering if there was a number, and you're saying that you don't know that, so that's fine.
Right. Of the 2,400, then, of that 2,400, that study actually whittled down to about 1,400 that they're actually doing telephone surveys with in the accuracy study. And of that set, ICANN privacy proxy activity is actually looking at any of those that appear to be privacy or proxy registrations and actually trying to determine whether, in fact, they are. So you would be definitely looking at a subset of, you know, some subset of 1,400.
Okay.
This is Adam Scovel. Just to make sure I understand what you're saying there. So the 2,400 is meant to be representative to a 95% confidence interval. The registrations of GTLD domains in the top five GTLDs, and we don't know whether whatever percentage of that 2,400 are eventually found to be proxy or privacy service domains are representative of to whatever degree of statistical significance of the population of overall of proxy or privacy registered domains. Is that a fair recap?
I think so.
Back to the question that you asked, I think as to, you know, whether this is useful, whether this goes to the original intent, I think part of it is that I sort of have to keep in mind in answering that question that proxies was only one aspect of what I think some of these studies were intended to go after, which was the question of legal versus natural persons in the registration, and the idea, the sort of, I guess, basic premise that, you know, if you're engaged in commercial activity, you ought to be identifying yourself correctly. And the question of how many commercial domain names are not being not accurately identifying themselves. And again, I just think that it's helpful to keep in mind, particularly since there's a whole other separate proxies study out there that proxies was only seen as one conceivable way in which commercial domain names might misrepresent themselves as having a privacy interest or as being owned by individuals, just one sort of one facet of what the overall purpose of this kind of study was going after, if I understand that correctly.
Yeah, I think I hear what you're saying, and I think that what Liz and I concluded when looking at the set of studies that have been proposed was that one study could actually answer several of these questions based on the same sample. So using the same methodology, you could go through and try to determine, you know, how many of these were legal persons representing themselves as a natural person, how many of these are representing themselves as a natural person in order to actually obfuscate the commercial purpose of the domain. You know, if you go through the same sample set and look at it in several different ways, you can derive that set of answers, I think, and address all six of the studies that were proposed and encompassed by this particular study definition. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I think I was also just sort of pointing out that this is not the study that's meant to be the be all and end all and answer all of our questions about proxies and privacies, and it's also not meant to exclusively be addressing proxy and privacy registration.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, and this is Bob Bruin again. One consequence, and I agree with what you said, a consequence is that if there is some kind of criminal activity going on, that will fall out of there because they would have been misrepresenting themselves anyway. It was not, it's not specifically mentioned, but it should just sort of naturally fall out of the study.
Right. Our thinking actually is that the result of this study could then be input to the subsequent study that actually looked at of the cases where we felt there was misrepresentation going on, you know, what is the nature of that, and has there actually been any harmful action or abuse associated with that particular domain?
Yeah.
So as it provides a springboard to then answer those additional questions.
Right.
Yeah, building on Bob's point, though, although I understand where the 2400 number comes up and so forth, to the extent that you're really looking to feed results from one study into another, when you get down to the level of the studies that really are looking at proxy and privacy services, it may be valid to ask the question whether your sort of derivative data set is at a level that's statistically significant for what you're intending it to answer at that stage. You know, if you're at that later stage talking about, you know, 150 proxy registrations or 600 proxy registrations, you know, is that significant at that stage? I know that's a bit outside the scope of this study, but there's that might conceivably lead you to, you know, go to a bigger study at this stage so that when you have whittled it down, you're still at a level that gives you that kind of confidence.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I think that those are good points, and my hope would be if the methodology, you know, is defined and works, then it could be repeated in order to expand the sample size. But it's a good point that as we get sort of derivative groups of the sample, you end up with smaller and smaller pools that might end up being too small. Any other overall comments on the hypothesis of the study or the objective of the study? All right, well, let's go on to talk about the approach a bit. So we've already talked a bit about the approach and the fact that what we would try to do is start with a representative sample of registrants in the top five GTLDs, trying to start from a sample that actually allows you to draw some conclusions about distribution by country and region. The NORC accuracy study did start with the 2,400 domains. And then for pragmatic purposes, because they were actually doing a telephone survey or are conducting a telephone survey, and it's just impractical to survey a very, very large number of registrants in many different countries, they actually ended up then with a smaller subset of that study that they will go forward with and really attempt to make a final ruling on the accuracy of that who is data. But the proposal here is that we start with their representative domain sample, in part because they've already done some of the legwork that would be needed by this study in terms of trying to categorize the nature of the registrant. And then look, starting with that sample, look at two dimensions. One we called ownership, and that's looking at whether a legal person tried to hide the use of the domain by doing one of two things, either by just supplying a natural person's name as a registrant name and not putting anything in registrant organization, or by trying to use a privacy service that would sort of imply that this was not a legal person. So looking at those two dimensions using the results of the accuracy study to whittle out cases where that information was actually inaccurate. The second dimension then is purpose. So beyond that, the question of whether it's a legal person or a natural person listed as the registrant, does there appear to have been an attempt to hide commercial use of the domain? And that's admittedly a little bit fuzzier in terms of the actual methodology that you would use to make that ruling. In this study, what we proposed looking at is two things. One is the website content associated with that domain, and the other is whether and how the domain was used for email based on some various web searches. So looking at those two dimensions and realizing that they do overlap, some domains would actually most likely involve both kinds of misrepresentation. Trying to then actually give us a basis for analyzing those results and their relationship to the use of privacy and proxy services. So I'm on page 3 looking at the questions at the bottom of page 3. I'm looking here for feedback on whether, you know, defining the study in terms of ownership and purpose. Does that make sense? Is what we're trying to do here clear to you? Do you think that it's the right way to go about looking at this? Feedback on that point.
This is Adam. I think it's useful. I think that there is I found myself struggling a little bit with some of the kinds of uses that wouldn't necessarily be captured by this. And one of the things that I think about is domain names that are owned just for the commercial purpose of owning the domain name and possibly selling it. And in many cases like that, I mean, yes, you may, those, in a bunch of instances, that may well come up as it, you know, falls into the category of domains that clearly have a bunch of commercial links and are, you know, clearly, you know, pay-per-click sites, but might also be a little bit difficult to determine because you may find names that are being owned just for the sake of ownership and possible resale later and are deliberately not having any commercial use put to them. You know, it's a commercial purpose, but the website is deliberately not commercial so as to, you know, deliberately sort of try and avoid, you know, legal action for cyber squatting. You know, you see stuff that's parking pages, and I think maybe that's just, I don't know, a recognition that there are some that this is not comprehensive in terms of the kinds of misrepresentation or that might be going on, that might exist, but I think that it would probably be very hard to differentiate a domain that goes to a parked page because this is someone who just owns a heck of a lot of domain names, and some of them may be legitimate, but some of them may be, you know, actionable in some way, versus just garden variety, you know, some individual registers a domain and hasn't used it yet or only uses it for private, you know, non-commercial email or whatever. It's very hard to differentiate, but we haven't been, just recognize we haven't been exhaustive in terms of how we're categorizing the kinds of misrepresentation.
Yeah, I think it's a point well taken, and as we go through this and talk a little bit about the methodologies used to decide, you know, whether something is being used for commercial purpose, it seems inevitable that there will be, you know, a group of sites that you can't really reach a conclusion about. And so how we propose to deal with that is to try to refine that analysis and rating process as the study is conducted, and to, instead of making it sort of an it is or it isn't commercial ruling, trying to maybe apply some kind of rating process so that there will be some cases that's clearly commercial, some cases that clearly aren't commercial, and then unfortunately there will be a number in that gray area.
Yeah, I think what's important, though, is how many in that gray area. If you find lots of them, then you got a big problem. There's only a few of them, and it's not such a big problem. But I think parked pages in general, if you bought it and intend to sell it, that's a commercial purpose. And if the registrar is helping you have a parked page, thinking one day you'll put it together, like in a week or so, for your own personal use, then that can be discovered more than just looking at the page, but contacting the registrar about the page.
Okay, that's a good. Those are good points, and I've made a note of that. And there may actually be some information that we can springboard off of coming from the accuracy study. I know that some of the questions that they plan to ask, might help us.
Yeah, that was
good. On that.
Yeah. So, this is Dave. This is all. One of the things you could factor in, Lisa, is the period of ownership. If somebody has registered a name for 5 years and it's parked, that's an extreme. It's likely that they're not sitting there contemplating, what does my web page look like? So you might be able to use that as one of a set of metrics to distinguish whether or not this is this is something that's being held for a secondary market, or is something that, I registered 3 weeks ago and I haven't had time to put up a web page.
Well, there's one other component to that, because I know in the criminal world that they oftentimes pretend they suspended a domain name and make it a parked page. So it's going to sit there for some amount of time until it gets recycled back into use again.
Right, and I think that's one of those, if you've had a domain for a very long time, the chances are you have some purpose for it other than a benign web composition.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
The other thing that might be useful, and that I'm seeing in the work that I'm doing right now, is changes of IP addresses on those pages that appear to be parked. So somebody who's thinking of a website is probably not moving them around from hosting company to hosting company, because that costs money. But in the case of something like 3FN, all the IP blocks go away, and then those same sites appear, months later at some other some other colo or some other data center, under the same domain, and they're still marked by the same block list.
Lisa, going to your questions on the bottom of page 3 there, just looking at the time and realizing that we're sort of going to be running a little short. I think that some of the comments that you've heard in the past few minutes are sort of go to the first question that you have at the bottom of page 3, we've got fairly good definitions, but we should just recognize that they're not comprehensive. There may be some other things out there. On your second question, when was the NORC list of 2,400 domains pulled together? How stale are they?
When was their first cut? I should be able to tell you that. I'm thinking April.
Yeah, March or April.
I mean, I think I would answer yes. There's some point when they grow too stale. I'm not sure when that would be, and that's partly going to be a question of when we actually get to the stage of having been put out for costing by people who might actually conduct this, and when that's been approved, and when actually someone is commissioned to go do that. I mean, if we don't get to the point of someone actually conducting this study for another year, a cut that was done in April of this year may be just maybe archaic. But it's hard to say what the cutoff point is. for me at least.
Yeah, I don't know how you define a criteria for that.
Yeah, it's going to be different depending on whether it's, I mean, the listed registration may have a very, very different quantification of sale from a legitimate one.
And you may see different trends in terms of how domains are registered and abused, changing on a you know, monthly or quarterly kind of basis.
Right. One of the things that I'm kind of hearing implied in some of the comments that were made is that looking at the domain content once might not be enough.
Possibly.
And some of the comments there about, park pages being, suspended, suspended sites that are, parked for a little bit and then recycled for some other use, and looking at frequency of change of IP kind of implies to me that you might actually need to look at content more than once in order to, at least in the gray area cases, in order to make a decision or ruling. Okay, let's move on a bit. I would like to talk about the inputs to the study, looking a little bit more closely at NORC's accuracy study. And one of the advantages, if their sample is not to sale, or even if it is applying the same process to generate a new sample, is the fact that they have developed a methodology for mapping who is registrant information into two types. And so their methodology, right off the top, eliminates two classes of registrants where the who is information is either just missing or just so clearly inaccurate that there's not enough there in the registrant name and information, name and organization fields in order to look any further at misrepresentation. The next group then are the domains that, based on registrant name and organization and the NORC process of actually looking to see whether the organization is an Inc. or LLC and is defined in DUNS or something like that, to look to identify which are clearly registered businesses, whether or not there's also an individual's name associated with them. And we would consider those to be within the scope of this study, but not to require any further digging because there wasn't an attempt to misrepresent anything. They're not using privacy or proxy services either. So that's part of the big pool, but not something that requires further analysis. The area where all the work would have to be done would be on the domains that were mapped either into natural persons because only a registrant name and not an organization were supplied, or classes that they supplied a name and organization, but the organization is not clearly belong to a business that's in any sense a formal business. And then the fourth category is anything that NORC decided looks like a privacy and proxy service registration being shunted off to the ICANN privacy proxy study for further analysis to come back and say, yes, this domain was registered with a proxy service, yes, this domain was registered with a privacy service, and here is the actual user's name. We don't have that information for proxy service registrations, but we will have it for privacy service registrations. All that information would be coming to whoever actually does this study as a starting point. And that would be the basis then for further investigation into the content of a website or into the way that the site's been used to generate email.
So, Lisa, just to be clear, the four groups that you talked about correspond on page four to the first group, stuff where it's just missing or incomplete, is categories one and two. The ones that are clearly businesses but there's no misrepresentation are four and five. The ones that are the hard group are 3, 6, and 7, and the proxies are obviously 8. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I have one question on number two.
about patently false. I assume that someone's going to look at it and they see 999 for a telephone number is patently false. But we have found that there are a whole bunch of false things because they've got a state in a country that doesn't exist, or a postal code doesn't match up with this, or the phone number's in a different country. And those are a little harder to pick up just by looking at them unless you've got a really good sense of geography and, you know, numbers. I was wondering if there was some other criteria that someone had to look to see if the stuff was false, like a 2A for more detailed stuff.
What NORC would actually do in that case was would be to they're following up with the telephone survey to try to identify which values were actually incorrect and why, and we would be getting that information back from that study, which would be based on telephone and
okay, so they're looking at some of the other things that could be false in there. Okay.
Right.
I just see someone looking at a patently false is, you know, I've seen some really weird things, no such street name, you know, and it's really easy, but some of it's a little more difficult.
Right.
You don't know all the states in Brazil or something, you know.
Right, and certainly in the contact information, that is the subject of the accuracy study. And, you know, that actually might be some input then to this study in terms of, you know, how much other inaccuracy was there in the WHOIS data. But what this class 2 here was specifically looking at was just the registrant name and registrant organization fields. And if there really isn't even a name supplied, there's really no further you can go with it.
They didn't even make it to an attempt.
Right.
Okay.
You know, I would say on your second bulleted question there as to whether categories 1 and 2 should be counted as misrepresentation, I would say, and this is Adam again, I would say that they definitely should be counted as misrepresentation, because I think the principle that you're starting from is that if you're conducting a commercial business, you have an obligation to identify yourself accurately. And in a lot of cases, you know, if you're conducting business or reaching out and, you know, taking orders from or whatever in a particular jurisdiction, in many cases it's going to be a violation of the you have to register to do business in a state or whatever, and not identifying yourself accurately would start to run afoul of that. And it doesn't necessarily matter that the way in which you're misrepresenting yourself is to suggest that you're a natural person instead of a corporation. The fact that you've got bogus information in there or no information in there is another category of misrepresentation. So I would say it should be included.
So you're saying that for those domains, you would actually want to go the sort of the next step of looking at the content of the website, et cetera, to see does this appear to be actually a commercial domain?
Yes. For a commercial domain, you ought to be identifying yourself accurately. You know, maybe not if you're a free speech protester in Iran, but you know, but if you're selling sneakers online, yeah.
Okay, I understand the point they're making.
And I agree with him. I'll add to my voice to that.
There was one sort of comment that I had overall, and this might be as good a place as any to insert it, and that is the question of the legitimacy of you know, who can, and I use this term loosely, legitimately use a proxy or privacy service. And I think that one of the things that comes down to this, and I think you saw this in the email of comments that Steve Metallitz sent in, since he couldn't make the call, is that there is almost no legitimate commercial use of a proxy service. I mean, you don't have a privacy right. The one example that I could think of, which is also illustrative in terms of how, you know, where the line could be drawn, is, you know, say you have a secret product that you're going to launch and you don't want people to know about it, but you want to get your ducks in a row and you want to register the relevant domain names and so forth. You know, one fairly well-known example was before the iPhone was launched, there was a company called Ocean Telecom Services that went out and applied for a whole bunch of iPhone trademarks, and it turns out obviously that was a proxy in the informal sense for Apple Computer. And I would imagine that in addition to trademark registrations, they tried to go out and do the same thing for domain names as well. Now, that might be a legitimate use by a commercial entity of a proxy service or something like that. I mean, if they're not using a proxy, and there is in fact a company that's been formed that's called that, there's no law that says your company name has to be intuitive. But if they're using a proxy, there's a very limited way in which that might be okay, and that might be that the product isn't launched and there's no commercial use being made of that domain. It's purely parked in anticipation of launch. So, but once you've gotten to the point where you're sort of looking at the website, once you're determining that there is commercial use going on the website, then it becomes very easy to make a dividing line, because at that point, once your product is launched and you're out there in front of the world, then if you're a commercial entity, you really ought to be identifying yourself, and that limited sort of exception goes away. So that's maybe just sort of rationale for why it really is okay to be fairly absolute in saying that if your domain is used commercially, it is a misrepresentation to be using a proxy service at that stage. As Steve says, the very fact of use, if it's a commercial website, the very fact of use of a proxy is a misrepresentation.
So this is Liz. I mean, I guess I could come up with a scenario where that might naively not be the case. I mean, the mom and pop business where literally they have a very small client base and they, think that they're persuaded by privacy and proxy ads that, say you don't want to get spam. This is a useful additional service. We'll be the intermediary for you if there are any questions, and that's one less, check the box here and for $2 extra. I could envision a situation where someone who's not a criminal finds a privacy service useful.
I can see them finding it attractive or useful, but generally if they're doing that, they're going to have to register to do business, and all the kind of regulation, no matter the fact that you're small scale and that you may and that your commercial life may correspond to a certain extent to your personal life, you don't necessarily legally get to make that distinction if you're going to be conducting commercial activities. Now, you haven't given up your privacy right with respect to a domain that the same person may use to, put their photos of their kids on or whatever. But just in the same way that a major corporation's Whois record may contain the name of an individual who is their IT administrator, but there's much more of a public interest in that, oftentimes another analogy is your corporate registration. You name a registered agent, and that may well be an individual who, in some sense, has some privacy information. But if it's part of their job and they are submitting to put their information as a registered agent or whatever in a corporate record, it's hard to say that they have a legitimate interest in concealing that through some sort of proxy or privacy. In that capacity, you really don't. No matter that you may be small scale.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because if you go to a bank and you tell me you want to have a business account, or if you register your business with your state or whoever, or the IRS, all that stuff is going to be listed and it's got to be done correctly. We're just following into their footsteps, I think. So I think what you said is absolutely correct.
Well, I'd like to just put in a caveat because you're assuming intent, and you know this is a snapshot of domains you're going to look at, and if you happen to hit a very small window where IT hasn't gotten their crap together and they haven't gone and changed the registration from one one to another, or they just sit there and think, I'm just going to wait until the renewal comes up. There's no intent there to deceive, and there's no intent to misrepresent. It's very different than somebody who's hosting something that is an illegal farm or an illegal MP3 download or something else like that, who is using the service purely as a cloak and for deception. So I think we have to be real careful to draw the very sharp distinction that Steve is trying to draw.
I also agree with that, but I got to tell you, from personal experience and several years of looking at this stuff, I haven't seen very many legitimate users of the privacy protection stuff.
Oh, I agree with you.
Anecdotally.
This is Liz. I think we have the issue identified at this point, and I want to make sure that we take the rest of the time.
Okay.
We're not going to resolve it on this call. I understand it.
I just want to bring it up.
Yeah, and appreciate the discussion, too, very much. Lisa, let's go to the next point.
All right. Let's see. I guess that the one item here that we've touched on several of these sort of tangentially here, if not directly, in Section 3. The one question that we haven't touched on is whether registered businesses that turn out to be, really a business holding onto a domain for someone else, domain reseller, or an internet service provider that's actually developing websites for other businesses, whether we need to treat them differently in terms of misrepresentation. Any thoughts on that?
I would answer with respect to a small-time web designer or a hosting company or something like that that's basically just been hired to register the domain for someone. I would say you ought to treat that differently, partly because there's just a sort of a different profile there. But I think it does raise some of the same concerns. In terms of the registrant's rights, it's not exactly a best practice to have an ISP who's claiming ownership of your domain. There's the sort of sense in which, if you're conducting your business as, XYZ Floral Shop, you ought to go and be able to see who owns that domain, and it's a little bit of obfuscation if it's going to say, Johnny's, web design. But it's different enough that I would say that some of the same issues exist, but you ought to categorize it separately.
And you started that comment by talking about, the smaller, web design companies, but would you apply the same logic to domain resellers, or would you?
I'm not sure that I would. I would say that it's. I'm not sure that that's necessarily a proxy, and I don't think it's the same category as the small-time web host. I would say that is a business, and that's commercial. They may be just owning the domain name just for the sake of owning the domain name. I'm not sure that's either. Not sure that that's a proxy.
The last time we had a chat with somebody working on the NORC study, they also had not decided how to deal with those quite yet, whether that was going to become a different class entirely as well.
I mean, by domain reseller, I think we're talking about like a company that makes its business of owning domain portfolios, perhaps for underlying people who may own those portfolios. It seems to me that entity is itself making a business, making a go of it. There may be someone behind that curtain, but it's less direct. XYZ Domains does own that domain in its own capacity, at least to a certain extent. You know, even if there may be, you know, Joe Smith, the big domainer, who's, you know, the wizard behind the curtain.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'd like to move on and talk about the output section, which is actually where you know, some of the methodology of how we decide how to categorize the results really comes into play, and I'm hoping to get feedback on that. So as we talked about before, you know, we'd be looking to try to categorize the domains by you know, whether there was some attempt to misrepresent ownership, purpose, both, and cases where that kind of fell into the gray area, or cases that could completely be eliminated as having any misrepresentation at all. But to make that decision, there were basically two methodologies proposed. One was to try to resolve the domain to a website and then examine the website content to make a decision about whether it appeared to be commercial or not. And what we've defined here is looking at that website, looking first for commercial transactions, the ability to actually purchase goods or services directly, and that seems to be clearly a commercial site. Then there's the category of sites that, while you can't go to the site and buy something, it's actually a company website that advertises that company's products or services, and that seems to be where many commercial websites would fall. And another category here, third category, would be a case which doesn't sell anything directly, doesn't promote goods or services, but is one of these sites that generates a significant portion of revenue by advertising. And this one is a little bit fuzzy because you wouldn't necessarily want to categorize a website with a little, you know, Google ad on it as commercial if the primary intention of the site was not commercial. But there are clearly sites that generate a lot of their revenue through advertising. And then the fourth category is the clear, the case of the domain parking page, which we talked earlier about it not being clear, you know, whether exactly what the nature of that site is. We may not be able to determine whether that eventually has commercial use or not. Any feedback on that as a methodology for defining what is commercial? Are there other ways to look at a site's content and define what is commercial, and do you see issues associated with using an approach like this?
I have a problem with the third set. Just because you are not selling goods or services, but you're taking money from ad revenue, that makes you commercial. I mean, the basic legal definition is, you, Liz should know, you know, the transaction, and, you know, you exchange something. And they get to look at the ad, and they get some money for the ad. I'm sorry, users look at the ad, and you collect money for it. You don't have to sell a particular thing, but that
I don't think that they're saying that they said that this is non-commercial.
It says right here, that alone is not enough to constitute a commercial purpose.
No. I think that the last sentence in that bullet, if I read it right, is meant, tell me if I'm reading this wrong, is meant to distinguish those categories from the kinds of sites that are talked about in the first two sentences of that bullet point. Is that correct?
I'm a little lost in the verbiage, but I'll restate what
we go. We have a third bullet point there, and you have the first two sentences that talk about sites that don't have commercial transactions, but there's a whole bunch of ad revenue, and most ad-supported online publications and search engines fall into this category. And there we define our category. And it seems like the stuff that, if that's Bob, who I heard there, the last sentence I think is meant to distinguish a different kind of thing. It's saying, oh, this isn't meant to entirely encompass stuff that just have a couple of small banner ads, but the main purpose is something else. Is that
right? That is correct, and maybe there would be a better way to describe that.
I still think they're commercial because they're taking money for those ads. You know, if you really have pictures of your cat up there and it's your personal page, you're not taking any money for it. But if you want to support the page by doing advertising, you've engaged in commercial activity. And they should be taken, at least looked at, I have no idea whether it's a little category or a big category at all, but I still think once you start exchanging money, it becomes commercial.
A lot of blogs probably fall into that sort of, let's call that sort of the 3A category. A lot of blogs might fall into that where it's, you know.
Yeah, but the whole thing is a blog is a way to attract people to look at the ads to make money.
Understood. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that we're really talking about two different things in that bullet point. And I think we can all agree that the first sort of the 3 is clearly commercial, and this 3A category, I think, can be commercial.
You just need some granularity. And I don't know whether you want to go to the distinction of if it looks like it generates under $500 a year, of revenue, then you consider it a personal site because that would not be something that anybody would have to declare in U.S. IRS terms. But I think that's too much of a granularity. I have sympathies with what Bob's saying. If you're taking money, you're taking money. I used to do that, and I stopped because I decided it wasn't the right thing to do. But half the time, people don't even realize when they put some of these, like a Google search or something like that, that they're just using for convenience because it's safe. They think it's safer, or somebody told them it's safer than using a script that they pulled down off the web. There's a certain amount of plausible innocence that you have to factor in as well. I had a different issue after this one. We closed this one, though.
I think I made a note of the issue, and there's clearly 3 is really 2 cases they should be described, and then there's the question of whether 3A is commercial or not. That's really, I guess, a policy question. But I've made a note of it.
Okay. The question of visiting the site and trying to determine whether it's personal or business also exposes the test to criminal activity or malicious activity, because visiting the site is not something you want to do if you have any suspicion that there's a malicious download or something else like that on the site, and visiting either by thumbnail or it might be preferable finding or visiting after you've gone through a list of block lists to increase the confidence that the site is non-malicious. I think visiting sites is kind of tricky. That's all you need to say about that.
But you can do it from virtual sites and things like that. You can take snapshots of them, recover it immediately, and
right.
Take some care is what you're trying to tell them.
Yeah, I think the RFP ought to well, I don't know what you're going to do. Is a criminal site going to be considered a business site? Or a
oh, absolutely. They're taking money in left and right.
That's a good point, Dave. And I've noted that how this is actually implemented does need to take into consideration the precautions that I can think of ways that you might do this, to protect yourself, but the points will take. And do you see any problem with actually being to access those sites, though? Because one of the problems that I see, let me answer my own question, is that in order to really make an assessment, you need to see more than the homepage of the site.
I think that's another good point. And I mean, the other things you can do, where you can go to Edgar databases, you can look for any indication in one of the other SEO metrics or About Us or Site Advisor or something else like that, or more than many Google tools to try to understand whether or not there's a commercial endeavor. In some of the work that I've been doing recently, what's kind of interesting is if you go to a place like About Us or Lynx or any of those other SEO kind of marketing tools, is they actually tell you about the site. They tell you, you know, how many people have been visiting it, you know, what the major demographic is, and they might actually be complementary tools to help you beyond actually looking at the content. Yeah.
Right, that's a great point. I've jotted that down. That could definitely be complementary to looking at the content itself.
I just want to talk to you quickly about it. I don't think this works because he's not going to have any idea what the goods are.
Okay.
So I think we're going to have to put something like either do a chart or...
Sorry, I guess I wasn't on the call.
One other comment, just in terms of this, our bullet points here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can do this, but it's sometimes a little harder to describe how we're going to do this. But obviously, you know, folks who are engaged in the IP enforcement side do it all the time. But the distinction between the sort of the category 3 sites and the category not 3A but 4 sites, in other words. I would sure hope that we would be able to distinguish between a page that's just full of links that is clearly generating revenue back to the registrant, and a page that's that is you know, similarly all full of links, but it's just a registrant's or registrar's or service provider's parking page that's not going back to the registrant. You know, we ought not to lose the threes by miscategorizing them as fours.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Good, thank you. All right, I've made a note of that as well. One of the questions that I wanted to ask about the topic of looking at web content relates to the original proposal. The original proposal differentiated between not-for-profits and other kinds of businesses. Is there, from the standpoint of misrepresentation, is that a necessary differentiation?
I guess I would say that any legal entity ought to be identifying itself correctly. That goes back to, I think it was one of your questions that you had earlier on, when you said, should the 6 and 7 category folks be counted as natural or legal persons? And I would say, yeah, they ought to be counted as legal persons.
Okay, good.
You know, the only exception to that I would say is it's not just the fact that you have something in the organization field. You know, for instance, sometimes you see that people just sort of not realizing the significance will put the same name in both the person and organization field. And if I put Adam Scoville in the person and I put Adam Scoville in the organization, that still may be a personal site. So it's more than just a non-blank field in the organization thing.
That's a good point. I can't remember how the NORC study would handle that as they pursued the accuracy of the entry, but I'll check into that. All right. Then in addition to looking at web content, because there would be some domains that don't resolve to a website of any sort, the study definition talks about looking to see whether there's an MX record, whether there's any record of use of the domain through some general web searches, looking at reputation sites like Spam House and Fish Tank. Looking at social networking sites and just doing a generic Google search. Any thoughts on that is that a useful extension to looking at the website content? Can you think of other ways to complement looking at the website content to make a ruling on commercial versus non-commercial use?
You're not saying that the mere presence of an MX record means it's commercial, right?
No, absolutely not. No.
Okay, I would agree with that, particularly since a number of registrars, you know, automatically set up a free forwarding email address that would, you know, that would probably probably result in an MX record being created.
But how far would you go beyond, you know, MX records? I mean, if you register a domain and, you know, and you look at the zone file and you see Ventrilo or you see some other, you know, SIP or voice service, is it commercial? Is it private? I'm just wondering, you know, whether you have to do something more than MX, and then if you do, how far do you actually go? You know, you find somebody who's hosting FTP or who's, you know, who's doing something else that's peer-to-peer or running a, you know, somebody who's running an AOL, you know, or not AOL, an IM kind of server or chat room. You know, certain alarms ought to go off for some of that activity, and you know, for others maybe not.
So I think I understand the point that you'd have to figure out where to draw the line somewhere. The question that I would have is whether we should take that extra step at all, or whether we should just look at web content, and then if we do take that extra step, what do you think are the, you know, the minimal and most useful extra steps to take?
Well, one thing that would clearly, or in my mind, would have a very high probability of indicating a commercial rather than private use would be an IP block of, you know, assigned by, you know, by some regional RIR to, you know, to the organization. Most people can't afford, you know, a /24 or even a /25 for personal use. So that might, and, you know, something that has to do with addressing might be, you know, might be appropriate. Trying to think of other, you know, so, you know, it, and if in fact there, you know, I guess I'm wondering if there's some correlation you can draw with where the zone files are listed, and whether it's an individual or a business. That's a little bit tougher.
For me, this is Adam. I would say my jury's out on whether you should go further than web content. I can imagine, like others, I can imagine ways that might be productive, whether they're productive in proportion to the amount of work that it would take or how clearly determinable the results you'd get would be. It's hard to say.
You also have to keep in mind how many of these there might be. You know, if you only have a few exceptions like this, I mean, you don't want to put too much effort into it because it's not worth it. But when you don't know what it's going to look like in terms of how many are going to show up, it's a little hard to determine.
That's a good point as well.
Well, you know, Lisa, I mean, in defense of the MX record, it's probably the only thing that what you would consider a mainstream, non-technical user might actually have other than other than a website. You know, you just don't see that many, you know, non-technical people running FTP, running Telnet. You know, I mean, there are some, but it's probably a much smaller percentage than those of us who understand, you know, all the pre-web applications, would admit to. I could see people, you know, getting MX because they're going to go into some sort of mail business, and, you know, perfectly legitimate mail business, and pushing, you know, prior to to RSS feeds, you know, and the like. I can see that there might have been, you know, and still are people who run, you know, run mail services. Yeah, and you know, just for their own personal use, for their, you know, collections of friends, for fantasy football leagues, things like that. But I don't know whether, you know, and I could see some things like, you know, VoIP servers, but those are the only two that would come up, top of my head, as the things you might see among average users.
Okay, I've made a note of those points. And a lot of what we've been talking about has covered the questions that I had on the bottom of page 7, methods and criteria used to differentiate commercial and non-commercial, and to look to see whether it appears that the registrant's not a natural person. The other question that we had here I'd like to direct your attention to is what we wanted to get out of the study. So based on the data that would be collected, we'd be able to categorize this sample, natural versus persons versus legal persons, looking at it broken down by TLD, by region or country, and by which of these were privacy and perhaps proxy use. We'd be able to do the same thing broken down for legal persons, differentiating between the commercial and non-commercial purpose. The question is, other than the four items that are listed here, are there specific questions that you think a study like this should try to answer?
I don't want to add to the study's load. I think it's enough as it is. But I would be interested to know, based on what my experience looks like, as to how many just phony things there are out there beyond just the privacy stuff, because you will come across a lot of whois data that's going to be blatantly wrong, hidden wrong, and then some that are using protection just because they're doing criminal things and whatever else like people have brought up that's going on. So I think most of what you're going to want is listed there. But I don't know if it'll be the end-all or be-all of whether whois is okay or not.
Well, certainly there are other questions to ask. What I was really looking for here, though, is whether there were specific questions we should try to make sure instrumented the study to try to answer.
We are keeping track, aside from the question of misrepresentation, of just overall percentage of domains that are legal persons versus natural persons. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so there will be some information here that just generally puts the sample into the different buckets, and then some that tries to interpret it based on TLD, based on region, country, and then based on whether or not privacy and proxy were used, recognizing there's not as much we can do with the proxy ones.
As long as you've got small enough units, you can always reassemble the data later.
Exactly. Well, great. I've gotten a lot of useful input here. Are there any other thoughts that people would like to share on this?
Not I.
I guess you're free.
All right, good. Liz, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you all very, very much for your time. This was a useful call and a long call, so really appreciate your input. If more occurs to you, just email me, and I'll make sure. I think Lisa's on the invitation, too, so you could email the both of us. But we have a window of, say, the rest of the week for further thoughts. And I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
I do, too.
And you'll hear more from us about further studies.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, all.